Four Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Bank, now serving you with two locations, a friendly bank in a friendly town. Now, here's your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is radio historian collector Ed Corcoran. Ed, we have a sports announcer tonight that is familiar to every one of our listeners, I'm sure. I'm talking about the great Mel Allen.
Gee, how about that, Dick?
Okay, I knew you'd try that. Mel, it's good to have you with us here on the Golden Age of Radio.
Well, after what Ed just said, I think that's the end of the program, isn't it?
No, not quite.
But I appreciate your most generous introduction. Nice being with you.
Mel, it's a pleasure to have you here. As a matter of fact, you spoke earlier today at the Silvertown restaurant in Meriden, and Bob Siraki, the manager of Silvertown, was so nice to arrange this for us today. Mel, we're going to talk about sports eventually, but because our program is devoted to the Golden Age of Radio, there's an aspect about your career that we want to find out about, and that goes back to the early days of CBS, when you and Bert Parks worked the night shift.
That's right. When I first joined CBS, actually, believe it or not, I had done some football games while I was in law school, quite by accident, as it turned out. I won't go into all the details, but I got a chance to join the network as a result of it, and I thought I'd like to live in New York for a few months before I started practicing law, but it turned out I stayed there. But I first started out working the early morning shift. I opened up the network 6 o'clock in the morning, but then I was rather accustomed to it because, you know, making 8 o'clock classes at college, you used to have to get up about, well, 6:30 maybe anyway. Sure. To make them, so it didn't make much difference, and I lived right in town. But believe it or not, I never even knew how to make a station break when I got to the network, because all I did was do football games in college. Other fellows made the station breaks, and I didn't know anything at all about radio, and of course, the longer I stayed in it, the more letters I got emphasizing that fact. But anyway, later on, they switched us over, and Bert and I, there were others, but Bert and I primarily handled the dance band shows, which was your 11-1 prime time, let us say.
That's right.
Instead of like the Tonight Show, you did dance bands in New York. Sometimes they would switch out to Chicago or San Francisco or Los Angeles, but primarily most of your great bands were playing in and around New York City. We used to get a kick out of alternating doing Benny Goodman and Tommy Dorsey, Glenn Miller. Sammy Kaye was a tremendously nice fellow, but I didn't particularly
like
care
music.
About his music. In fact, one time, he was so meticulous. We used to have a sheet with all the numbers that had been cleared, you know, for BMI and the ASCAP,
And
then they would select the numbers out of the cleared numbers, and then I would put down number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the order in which you're going to play them, and I would announce the tunes. Except Sammy liked to be introduced and then announce his own tunes. And we had a mimeograph sheet and a standard opening. CBS takes great pleasure in presenting for your dancing pleasure the music of blank, coming to you from blank, and then you'd go on. And one time at the Commodore Hotel, where Sammy was playing, I went down there, and of course you memorized that opening by then, you know, or after a while. And I was looking at the dancers, and Sammy is there directing his band and that theme, you know, and the whining trombones and all that. And I said, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. CBS takes great pleasure in presenting for your dancing pleasure the music of Sammy Kane's orchestra coming to you from the pool room, I mean the palm room of the Hotel Commodore in New York City. It was a Freudian slip, truthfully. And he liked to fall off the dadgum bandstand because he thought I had, you know, belittled him. But we remained good friends. I told him, you know, it's just one of those slips of the tongue, just like one of his musicians play a wrong note sometimes.
Sure,
you know.
Sure. But you actually, you find yourself standing back after announcing the introduction to Benny Goodman or whatever band it might be, almost in awe, almost as though you didn't believe what was happening.
Well, it's true because, see, only a year and a half or two before, I was still in school. And few seasons before that, you always were tuning in late at night and listening to the bands, you know, being broadcast. You could get to Chicago direct at the university. The others would come through the stations near Tuscaloosa. But listening to them all, and then, you know, hear Bing Crosby's recordings and things of that kind, all of a sudden, there you are standing introducing these bands and meeting these people, you know. It did take you a while to...
I was just wondering, were they ever doing anything at Frank Daly's Meadowbrook in Cedar Grove, New Jersey, on the Pompton Turnpike?
I was about to tell you that, yeah. But first of all, the first time I was ever assigned there, I went out a little earlier, because, you know, to find your way over. But once you'd been there once or twice, then you could drive over almost blindfolded. Not only there, but at the Glen Island Casino. Glenn Gray and his Casaloma Stomp Band or whatever. Anyway, Glenn Gray's band. And, oh, gosh, there was so many. And I see now Joe Venuti is coming back. All the guys are coming back. Certain guys have played in those bands, you know, had their own bands. Glenn Miller, of course, is another one. I used to do a commercial show. I did Harry James, who was part of Goodman's original trumpet section. And for a cigarette outfit, and Glenn Miller for the same cigarette outfit on two different networks. And strangely, one time, Fred Waring was on one network from 7 to 7:15, and Harry James was on the other network, 7:15 to 7:30. Now, the announcer that did Fred Waring's show left to go on a vacation. Well, instead of hiring a replacement for him, they got me to do both shows, one following the other, but on two different networks, and one studio about six blocks from the other. But they arranged it so that I did the last commercial about 2.5 minutes before the end of the Waring show, and I had a cab waiting outside. I dashed off stage, jumped into the cab. A police friend of mine went with me. We went through red lights, and boom, we were there, and I would jump out of the car and dash in through the rear entrance, and that brought you right out on stage. The producer had the script ready, and I think only one time did he ever have to do the opening line, but otherwise, I'd make it about 10, 15 seconds to grab the script. Of course, I had looked it over, you know, earlier in the day, and just come on nonchalantly like nothing ever happened. See, but two completely different networks.
Let's let our audience listen to one of those old band remotes.
How do you do, everyone? For the late dancers, CBS offers Benny Goodman and his orchestra, coming to you from the Manhattan Room in the Hotel Pennsylvania in New York City. We move along in the Goodman stride with that Big John special. Benny Goodman and the boys interpret an old-timer, All of Me.
CBS has offered the music of Benny Goodman and his orchestra, coming to you from the Manhattan Room in the Hotel Pennsylvania in New York City. Melvin Allen speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
That takes us back to a long time ago, to the late 1930s or so, and we're going to talk about Mel Allen in sports.
May I make just a slight interruption? It wasn't the late 30s. It was the last year in the 30s. I'm not as old as people think. It's 1939 and 40, and 41.
We'll talk about sports right after this.
Perhaps 1975 is the year you've decided to improve your home's exterior appearance. Maybe it's a new driveway you need, or a complete landscaping job with new plantings for the front of your home. Or, with the warm weather we've been experiencing, perhaps the desire for your own swimming pool or backyard patio is stronger than ever. If that's the case, stop in and get complete information on a home improvement loan from the folks at the Cromwell Savings Bank. They're at two locations now to serve you. The main office, located at the corner of Main and West Streets, is open daily Monday through Wednesday, 9 to 3, Thursdays from 9 to 5, Fridays 9 to 7:30, and Saturdays 9 to 12 noon. The new Cromwell Plaza office near Kmart is open Monday through Thursday, 10 to 4:30, Fridays 10 to 7:30, and Saturdays 9 to noon. At either office of Cromwell Savings Bank, you'll get friendly expert advice on home improvement loans that can make possible those interior or exterior improvements to your home. Visit them soon. The Cromwell Savings Bank, now with two locations, member of FDIC and an equal housing lender. Now, once again, your hosts, Ed Cochran and Dick Bertel.
Mel Allen is our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio. And Mel, I'm sure that our listeners want to know, as I want to know, how you first became associated with sports at the network.
Oh, at the network. Well,
of course, we have to back, I suppose, a little bit.
Yeah, well, I did football at college. Wasn't good enough to make the varsity. I played intramural sports, but I wanted to make a letter. Went out student manager and got the benefit of all the coaching. And I played my intramural sports, but when I got into law school, I started filling out physically and then played some semi-pro ball around. But in the meantime, all of a sudden, they needed somebody to broadcast the University of Alabama's football games. Radio announcers were not as plentiful in those days as they are today, and the one fellow that was doing the games in Birmingham, 50 miles from Tuscaloosa, left to take a job in another city. 10 days to go. People are frantic. They call everybody around to take a think of. Anybody you know can broadcast football, and among them was the head football coach at Alabama. He gave my name among the duties of student managers handling the PA system. And all you did on a PA system, you know, was just announce the lineups and the substitutes. Or, you know, Dr. So-and-so call your office type of thing. And he thought that was tantamount to broadcasting, so he gave my name. And they gave me an audition. I won it and found out later I was the only guy that took it. That's how frantic they were. I got the job and did the games. And out of that came an opportunity to join CBS. And I thought I'd go and live there 6 months after getting out of law school. And then thought the experience would be valuable and then go back to Birmingham and practice law. But all of a sudden, after a few months, I got a nighttime commercial show, Pick and Pat, for another tobacco company. And they were paying me more for that than I got for working a whole week for the network in those days. And then I got to, they took me off regular staff and made me understudy to both Ted Husing, who was the number one sports announcer in the country.
He sure was.
And also Bob Trout, who was the nation's number one special events reporter. CBS happened to have had them both. So that I got a dual type of experience. And as a result, in addition to doing some sports, and we had two sports events on a day, I even worked on presidential campaigns. Bob Trout would be your anchor man, as they call him today, like a Cronkite or John Chancellor. But I was number two to him and got into, I remember when President Roosevelt, may his soul rest in peace, was being was taking the oath of office, the inaugural. It was his third term. And they stationed me in the dome of the Capitol. And now, they had different announcers along the way. Trout, of course, was at the center, you know, the anchor. And you had your headset on, and you'd hear him. There'd be a producer, of course, that'd pass a note to him, and there would be a message, and you could hear all these messages, or John Reed King, or David Ross, or Paul Douglas, whoever. We had a great staff, by the way. Ralph Edwards was on it, and so forth. We're coming to you in a minute. So they were ready, you know, and I could look out from the dome of the Capitol, a very bitter cold day, and I could see the parade, you know, I mean,
the procession,
the line of automobiles. In a sense, it's parade, but it's another word I wanted. But anyway, they're coming up Pennsylvania Avenue, and I was to pick them up from the dome of the Capitol as I could see them as they approached it, and they had to go around it to the front where the stairs were and the bleachers and all the thousands of people out front, bring him around to that point, and then switch it back to Bob Trout, and he'd pick it up until it was time for the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to swear in the president. And so I did, and when I finished, I turned it back to Bob, and now I take a seat between the columns at the top of the Capitol Dome, and I had it was a terribly cold day, and I borrowed a heavy coat somewhere in Washington, but it's one of those old coats. It wasn't a raccoon type, but it was similar. It was like these pile rugs.
I know what you mean.
But it was
a
cinnamon brown color and had a big collar, and I had it up over my head, and I'm looking down. And, of course, I'm getting a wallop out of this, man.
Sure.
I'm still a kid, you see, and I don't think you get old enough to ever get over those kind of things as that's concerned. And I'm looking down right over the heads of, the people in running our government and watching all of this, see, when all of a sudden something grabbed me by the shoulder and jerked me like you'd jerk an oyster out of a shell or a clam out of a shell. And I turned around, and here must have been a dozen Secret Service guys with drawn revolvers. Anyway, what it turned out, some of the people way out front, you know, the thousands were watching, it seemed that I looked like a brown bear sitting up on top of the dome,
mm-hmm.
looking down. And the word went out, what is a bear doing up there, you know? Well, actually, if they'd just stopped to think, to get up there, I needed about 15 different kinds of cards, you know, to show to get up there. But they scared the devil out of me with those drawn revolvers, I'll tell you that.
Were you able to do the broadcast after
that? Yeah, we got to be buddies, you know. And I said, now you fellas going about your business because I'm going to have some business to tend to myself in a little while. And I said, if you want to talk this over later, we'll do it.
But right now,
I got to get back on the air pretty soon. And they all started laughing, you know.
Well, Mel, how did you move into sports?
CBS had an exclusive on the Poughkeepsie Regatta. And NBC, you know, competitive, as they are, all networks are, all stations are, they sent Graham McNamee up in an airplane to swipe it from the air on the theory that CBS only had an exclusive on the ground rights and not the air rights.
Mm-hmm.
So the following week, CBS had an exclusive on the Drake relays out in Des Moines, Iowa, and or NBC did, and just to get even, CBS assigned Ted to go out there and climb up on a telephone pole and with field glasses cop the Drake relays from NBC that way. And additionally, it happened that Long Island was just full of sports activities that day. The prime event was the Vanderbilt Cup races, which was somewhat like the 500-mile Indianapolis race,
mm-hmm.
except it wasn't 500 miles. But where the trotters are now, they used to have automobile races anyway. So they decided to send me up in an airplane, and I had never flown before, number one. I was just scared to death. about that. In fact, I went up for the trial run for the shortwave technicians trying out their shortwave from being up in the air and down below. And NBC had it exclusively down below. So just to make it appear that we weren't trying to swipe it from them, there was a state tennis match going on out there. There were sailboat races going on out in the sound and things like that. So we went up in the plane, went on the air. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I remember somewhat the opening line. This is Mel Allen speaking to you on behalf of the Columbia Network. Circling in the Eastern Airlines plane, which they donated for the plug, and now they got a second one years later. Long Island is the mecca of the sports world today, and I was talking about all these other events except the automobile race, but this is what we finally got to. We timed it. We knew what time they were supposed to take off. Now, the only script I had, because this came up at the last moment, I cut out of the New York Times the lineup of the automobiles, just as you'll have in the 500-mile race. Three cars to a line and 11 lines deep, 11 rows deep, 33 cars. I had done other homework during the week when I found out about it, but the only actual script I had was just simply the lineup of cars. But I had done a lot of reading about it, and I knew that there were certain hairpin turns in the race that were very dangerous, and in the event of rain, that they were going to postpone it from the Saturday, it was scheduled to the following Monday. Now, McNamee is on the ground, and I'm up in the air. And I was really up in the air because at the scheduled time, none of those cars moved.
I can see what
and
you mean.
And we keep circling and circling. And I was talking about everything that I had remembered, you know, from doing your homework. And finally, the producer slipped me a note, said, I guess we better go down. Something must be wrong. But he knew as well as I did that if it were raining, they were going to call it off. And it did look like it was raining. We were, you know, being upstairs, it was dark, and we see some little rain against the windows. So we went down, and sure enough, they'd called the race off. But we had no way of knowing it. Well, it turned out I had been on the air ad-libbing some 52 minutes. And some vice president at CBS was listening and wanted to know who that was doing that. And that's how you get a break. So, that's like right. I say, you have to be at the right place at the right time.
Well, I guess you
But you have to be a little bit prepared, too. I'll have to add that for the benefit of folks who want to get into this business.
Well, of course, Mel, we all remember you from those golden days with the Yankees. Now, how many years did you actually do the Yankee broadcast? What year to what year?
Well, I would say approximately 23 years, 39 through 43, and I went in the service at the end of the 43 season, was selected to the World Series, but didn't get to do it by 11 days, and then came out in 46 and stayed with them through 64. I think if you add that up, it probably would come to approximately 23 years. After I got out of the Army, incidentally, it's 46 through 64. The reason a lot of people would jump on me, the majority of I'm trying to be as candid as I can, didn't. But as will often happen, those who do criticize you, whether it be someone in a letter or somebody writing a column for a newspaper or somebody on the air, any critic, will be magnified because you were with a dynasty. Because from 46 through 64, which is what, 19 years, the Yankees only lost the pennant in 46, in 48, in 54, and in 59. So in those 19 years, they only lost the pennant four times, so they won 15 times. And there was a stretch in there where they won five consecutive pennants and five consecutive world titles. Then they had another stretch where they won four pennants in a row. Then they had a second stretch in that series where they won five pennants in a row again, although they didn't win, they won something like three out of the five world titles. So that was a tremendous dynasty, and it just sort of kept building up, and even people sitting on the fence got tired of one team winning, you know, that type of thing. Or those who were against the Yankees got further against them. But instead of getting angry at the guys who did it, they got mad at me because I was broadcasting. I was the nearest person they could get to as far as the team is concerned. I had nothing to do with them winning. I didn't get one walk or one base hit or score one run or anything else. Somebody got a little more excited, but I had nothing to do with them winning or losing, for that's concerned.
Around the world, wherever American servicemen and women are stationed, it's game time. Time for Sports Quiz. Welcome, everybody, to Sports Quiz, the fans versus the experts, the lively game of give and take in which you men and women of the armed forces challenge outstanding experts with the toughest questions you can throw their way. And now, stepping up to the question box, the man who'll pitch the posers, the chief quizzer himself, Sergeant Mel Allen.
Thanks a lot, Ed Herlihy. Hello, everybody. Well, draw up a box seat and enjoy another set two with Sports Quiz, wherein our battery of sports experts strive to unravel knotty problems that pop up in a GI Bull session. This week's array of four stars is all set to meet your challenge in the form of sports teasers you send in from overseas. Remember, too, that in addition to their efforts to answer your questions, our guests are divided into two teams, the Reds and the Blues, and they'll compete against each other to see which team can come up with the most correct replies. So you see, it's a doubleheader, you fans versus the experts, and at the same time, the Reds against the Blues. Now the lineup for today's game. On my right sits the Blue team. The first introduction I'd like to make to you, news editor of the National Broadcasting Company, stepping in to show what he can do in the world of sports, Jesse Mass, and his teammate, that affable master football strategist and coach of the New York Giants, sizzling Steve Owen. On my left, the opposition, the Red team, consisting, first of all, of the new director of the Service Bureau of the National League, Artful Arthur Patterson, and his running mate, the guy who plays all positions on a field with equal facility, the Brooklyn Dodgers' own agile Augie Galland. All right, now, gentlemen, here are the ground rules. All questions have a point value fair to both sides. These points will be awarded at the end of each question and tabulated by our staff. Each team receives credit for as much of the question as it answers. The team that winds up with the highest total of points is declared the winner. And the prize? Well, it's just that good old-fashioned pride in winning. Now, if you fail to answer correctly, I ring the bell on you like this, and then the question is thrown to the other team for an opportunity to pick up extra points. And each time you miss a question, by the way, you owe the sender an autographed picture of yourself. All right, gentlemen, batter up. And working on the theory that a good start augurs well for a triumphant ending, we'll slip this easy teaser to the team of Owen and Mass and see if it'll help you get the feel of things, gentlemen. Sergeant Frank Anderson of the European Theater of Operations points out that the name of Jacobs is prominent in the sports world. That being true, as I name three sports, you should be able to quickly name a proper sports figure by the name of Jacobs to go with each sport. First of all, boxing.
Mike Jacobs.
Mike Jacobs, that's fine, Mr. Owen. Or you could have said the late Joe Jacobs. Tennis.
Helen Jacobs.
Helen Jacobs, that's right, Steve. Incidentally, this question is good for 3 points. And the third part, horse racing.
Hearst Jacobs.
Hearst Jacobs, absolutely right, and good for 3 points. Very good answer, Steve. All right, to the team of Patterson and Galland, Arthur Patterson and Augie Galland. With no malice of forethought, it's common knowledge that the Brooklyn Baseball Club, through the years, has been called many names, official and otherwise, and it's a case of every man to his own choice. However, Private First Class Bert Levy of the European Theater of Operations wants you to recall 3 nicknames by which the Dodgers have been known in the years past.
Well, I know one anyway, Mel.
All right, Augie.
Call the Robbins one.
Robbins, that's right, and that was...
That was after Wilbert Robinson, the former manager of the... Right, Mr. Patterson.
They're also called the bridegrooms, and they're also called the superbas.
Absolutely right. And then you get 3 points for your answer.
We'll return to the golden age of radio with guest Mel Allen in just a moment.
Get growing, get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank is growing too, to better serve you. Now with the new Cromwell Plaza office near Kmart. For your banking convenience, this new office also features a drive-in telewindow. When you open a new savings account with $50 or more, you'll receive an attractive gift from Cromwell Savings Bank's new Plaza office. Stop in soon. They're open Monday through Thursday, 10 to 4:30 p.m. Fridays, 10 to 7:30, and Saturdays, 9 to noon.
You grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member of FDIC, now with two locations to better serve you. Now, back to Ed Cochran and Dick Bertel.
Our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio is the well-known sportscaster Mel Allen. Mel, you obviously you had to know and work with Casey Stengel during those golden years of the Yankees when you were doing your broadcasts. How did you do as far as communicating with Casey was concerned?
That was the only part that you could call work. But it didn't take long, though, to figure out what he was talking about. And I really believe that having studied languages at college, like French and German, you're able to take his English and translate it. For example, the sports writers, you know, would come down, you know, to write certain notes. And I would come down. Naturally, when you're broadcasting, when you're off the air, you're through, that's it. But the writers have an opportunity to come down to ask questions, why he did this or that, get some notes. So they were asking him why he sent Enos Slaughter, whom they had gotten from the Cardinals, you know, to help him out in a stretch drive for the pennant, why he sent Slaughter up to pinch hit against a left-handed pitcher in the late innings. And I can't imitate Stengel, but he said, well, he played that fella out there in St. Louis long enough to know that a left-hander could hit a left-hander. That's his answer. Well, you got to know what he meant by that. He meant by that left-hander in St. Louis, Stan Musial. So he meant, of course, that Slaughter had played the Musial long enough to know that Musial, who could hit righties and lefties equally well, Slaughter could too. And so this is how you learn to translate things. And actually, Casey was always on stage. He was quite an entertainer. As a ball player, I found out when he beat the Yankees, for example, in a World Series playing with the Giants, when he hit an inside-the-park homer. He was a showbiz kind of a guy. And even when he was with the Dodgers, he was playing the outfield and he happened to see a little baby sparrow in the outfield one day. Somehow it fell off the nest on top of the fence or something, and he grabbed it and put it on his head, put the cap over. Nobody saw it. When he came up to bat the next time, the crowd applauded something he did, so he took his cap off, and the sparrow flew out and went away. Well, he was waiting for that, you see. And so he was always a showman. He was always on stage, but beneath it all, he was a brilliant manager. He simply did not have the ball players at Brooklyn when he was manager, or at Boston when he was a manager. And yet, when he went back to the minors, he won a pennant in Milwaukee, won a pennant at Oakland. And so when George Weiss became general manager of the Yankees, he brought Casey up. And Casey's philosophy was very simple. I play my strength against your weakness and my weakness against your strength. He knew as much about the players on the other ball clubs as he did his own.
Mel, you were part of the era of Husing, of Barber, of Allen himself. What do you think about sports figures who become broadcasters in later years? How do you feel about the industry today doing that?
Well, I have no objection to that. In fact, I don't know whether I was the first one to have an athlete working with me or not. I'd have to double-check that truthfully. But as I recall it, I remember doing an East-West game, which would always take place just before the Rose Bowl game. See, and I'd run up. I'd go back and forth. I'd watch practice down in Los Angeles and then fly up to San Francisco and watch practice a couple of days, do the East-West game, and then fly back to Los Angeles and then go over to Pasadena and do the Rose Bowl. Frankie Albert, remember the left-handed passer?
I remember him, yes.
He's a great one. And he did color with me on the East-West game. And he didn't do too good a job. I'm not being critical of Frank, but that was his first time out. Now, had he continued with it, and I think he did here and there, and he improved. It's just like anybody else. First time you start something, you know, you don't do it as well as you do if you continue with it and work at it. But the thing I object to is certain people today who put themselves first and the event second. And I don't care who the reporter is. You get a byline, you get your name mentioned that you're reporting. But if it wasn't for the event, you wouldn't have anything to report or say.
Oh, true.
But when guys get to putting themselves number one and the event is just incidental to their ribbing each other back and forth or this kind of thing, I think it's wrong. Yet, if the Nielsen ratings are great enough, this is important to the people who own the station. They can sell their time for more money. So they can take it from there. But we used to prepare. In other words, we'd come out. We were prepared so that, let's say it's a football game, and in your first moments before the game, the kickoff got underway, you would tell them what the philosophy was of each team, their defensive philosophy and their offensive philosophy, based on what they knew about the opposing team. They swapped films and had scouting reports. And then they each would tell you something, some new little wrinkle they were going to put in for the game. And you developed, as I said earlier, a client, a lawyer-client or a doctor-patient relationship. They knew that you were not going to tell the other coach what you learned from the coach it was you were discussing the thing with. Because once you ever broke that confidence, man, you might as well go looking for another job.
Sure.
Well, Mel, we'd like your opinion, you know, going back to baseball for a minute. You've seen all the great players, Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, right up to the present day. But the two, you know, during the heart of our period we're talking about, the golden age, were Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio. I wonder whether you might just give us, you know, your candid thoughts on them as ball players and how, you know, how you felt about them.
I had an interview with Joe McCarthy the other day. It was his 88th birthday. Of course, he managed the Yankees and the Red Sox after the Cubs. But having managed the Yankees and Red Sox, I had to ask him a question. And frankly, knowing Joe real well, I knew he wasn't going to answer it. But I also knew that the fans would want that question asked. And I think as a attempting to be a reasonably good reporter, or an adequate one, you often will ask a question. You may even know the answer to it.
Sure.
But you'd rather have the fellow, the player, the athlete, give the answer, because then that carries a little more weight than you're giving the answer, because they say, oh, he's just the announcer, but this other guy, he actually plays it. So it carries more weight, you see. But the point I'm trying to get at, you know the kinds of questions, hopefully, most of the time to ask. So I asked Joe, I said, Joe, you manage both the Yankees and the Red Sox. Most folks would like to know, in your opinion, who is the greatest, Joe DiMaggio or Ted Williams? And I knew what his answer was going to be. He said, they're both great. You know, and but yet I knew what his actual thoughts were. And it was proven by a poll taken on all the media and with the fans voting coast to coast about 3-4 years ago on the greatest, the poll, the question was, who is the greatest living ball player, active or inactive? And the winner was Joe DiMaggio. Now, I've been with Ted Williams many times, been fishing with him, I've been on Jimmy Fund raising, you know, fundraising drives, things like that. And Ted will tell you, Jiminy Crickets, I'm not in his league, is a total ball player. DiMaggio will tell you, there's no greater classic hitter that I've ever seen than Ted Williams. And it wasn't a mutual admiration society. They were giving you the honest answers.
They meant it.
However, that didn't mean that Joe wasn't a great hitter. He had a different philosophy of hitting than did Ted. Yet, Ted was slow. He couldn't help that. Just as like Brooks Robinson was slow, yet he was great on bunts, but he couldn't cover as much ground left or right as other third basemen. Something hit to his left, he didn't have to cover too much ground. He'd grab, he had great hands. But he had a quality of leadership. He had class and could hit well in the clutch. Ted could hit well in the clutch, but he had an element of stubbornness to which he would agree. When they put that overshift on him, he knew he was a great hitter, and he just wanted to show him he could beat it. And you just couldn't. You know, when you put everybody over on one side and left field is wide open, there's no third baseman, all you got to do is bunt the ball down there, and you walk to first base, you got a base hit. And he could have done that because he could control the bat, being the greatest hitter. He's the last hitter ever to hit over 400 in the major leagues. And we all know that, and he does too. But it's just a makeup of an individual, you see. Now, when he had to hit in a clutch sometimes, you know, on occasion, he could do it. I'm taking nothing away from Ted. I just mean it was just on a 3-2 pitch, eighth inning, ninth inning, winning run on second base. If the pitch was 3 inches outside or 4 inches, Ted would take it, take a walk. His theory being, if they start making you bite at pitches a little bit outside the plate, the next time it's going to be a little further until the first thing you know, they're making you bite at pitches a foot outside the plate or something like that. DiMaggio's philosophy was, in the same situation, the count of 3-2, if the pitch was a little outside the plate, as long as I could see the ball, meaning as long as it wasn't, he could see it well enough to realize he could get the bat on the ball, he's swinging, because he said, I'm not being paid fourth to walk. Now, this is a difference in philosophy. It didn't indicate that one guy was a better hitter than the other, because Ted could have hit those pitches out of the ballpark, and many times he did. By the same token, Joe didn't always get a hit by swinging at those kind of pitches.
That's right.
And therefore, his average would be lower. But I hate to compare ball players for the simple reason I think it's unfair. Joe happened to be a guy that was at the top or near the top in almost every department of the game. He led the league in hitting on occasion. He led the league in home runs on occasion, led the league in hitting. He was MVP 3 times. I think one time he was MVP when Ted ought to have gotten it, but Joe will be the first one to tell you that. But normally you play your best outfielder in center field, your second best outfielder in right, and the third in left. Joe played center, Williams played left, so you make your own deduction.
Now we got the mighty Ted Williams up here. We kind of like Ted Williams out our way. He's from California, you know. He broke in with San Diego, had his biggest minor league success out there. Of course, Joe DiMaggio is our real pet, our real favorite. Born and raised in San Francisco, down around Fisherman's Wharf. Ted, I don't think, is a native son.
There's an interesting thing here with Page and Williams, Bing. There's always a little personal feud going on there. Nothing in the way of any animosity, but Page has always been able to pitch to Williams pretty good, and Ted's always anxious to get a base hit off of him.
Well, any time a left-hander can get a base hit off a left-handed pitcher, it's quite an accomplishment at that. I guess Ted hits any kind of pitching. Here's the first pitch to him. It's called strike. It's two out. There's men on first and third, and Joe Page is pitching to Ted Williams in the first half of the sixth inning. The Red Sox leading 4-0. Ted stands up there with that wide stance. Steady, calm, cool, collected, flexes that big mace, and here's the pitch to him. He hits a high fly going up into left field. Should be an easy chance. But John, he has to go back a little. The wind got it, and he had to take it over his shoulder on a nice running catch. Looked like an easy fly out, but the ball got up in the breeze. The breeze is blowing right to left out here, and he had to take it on a dead run over his left shoulder. Gave the fans a little thrill sitting up in the stands here. So it wasn't the easy out that it originally appeared to be. So that ends the inning, the first half of the sixth for the Boston Red Sox. I don't think there was any hits. There's two walks and two men left.
That's right. No runs, no hits, no errors. Two men left. Mm-hmm. Bing.
Yeah, Mel.
I think they ought to make a picture called the Brothers DiMaggio, and you play Joe, and let Hope play Dominic. Why about that?
I'm an infielder, though. Second baseman. I can go to my right too for a ground ball. Can't make the throw, but I can go over there.
Well, friends, you've been listening to Bing Crosby, who's out here today as the guest of Del Webb, owner of the New York Yankees, watching the opening day festivities here at the stadium and doing a guest inning. And I certainly would like to repeat that we're naturally very proud, very privileged to have had that honor, Bing.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Mel, and I just hope I wasn't too confusing to the thousands of listeners you must have here in the metropolitan area.
Listen, I was getting ready.
I want to congratulate you on the great job you did during the World Series. Really a wonderful performance.
Thanks a million, Bing. I hope we have the chance of getting back into one again.
I imagine I'll hear you.
I was just going to say, I was on the verge of going out and picketing the place when you got on the air. You knock off a mean hunk of inning.
Sure.
And I can't sing. I mean,
nobody knows who's playing when I get through.
Thanks a lot, Bing Crosby.
Thank you, Mel, and goodbye.
We'll return to the golden age of radio in just a moment. With an ever-increasing cost of living, it's harder to save these days. Yet it's more important than ever to make that extra sacrifice to save. Why? Because tomorrow's dreams will be financed with today's savings. The best laid plans start with sound finances. Build a solid foundation for your future with a savings account at the Cromwell Savings Bank's new Plaza office, a new branch to an old family tree. Since 1871, Cromwell Savings has been the friendly bank, the dependable bank, and you can count on the Cromwell Plaza office to be the same. Stop in soon and inquire about any one of their six convenient savings plans. And remember, when you open a new savings account with $50 or more at Cromwell Savings Bank's new Plaza office, you'll receive a gift coupon for a 5x7 Loring portrait. Deposit $100 and you get an 8x10 portrait coupon. Or deposit $5,000 and choose from three beautifully designed decorator clocks. Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, where you can start the savings habit. Now back to Ed Corcoran and Dick Bertel and tonight's guest, Mel Allen.
We're running out of time. Did you know...
You know why? Ask an announcer one question, you got a 45-minute answer.
Did you know Babe Ruth?
Yes, I got to know Babe. Of course, his career had long been over, but I got to know him when they asked me to go around when he spoke to Little Leaguers and Babe Ruth Leaguers and high school students, American Legion students, and that sort of thing. So I got to know him pretty well. And he was a tremendous personality, professionally, certainly.
Were you there on that memorable day in April, Babe Ruth Day, at Yankee Stadium?
Yes. We had 2 days, one in 47 and a second one in 48. 48 happened to be the Yankee silver anniversary. And just 2 years ago, we had the 50th, or golden anniversary of Yankee Stadium. And on opening day, Yankees had beaten the Dodgers in 47 in the World Series. So the Yankees, after the march to the flagpole and the raising of the flag, you know, emblematic of World Championship by Bucky Harris, who then was Yankee manager, and Joe McCarthy, former Yankee manager, then managing the Red Sox, I introduced Joe DiMaggio won the most valuable player award, which he accepted, and his sincere, humble fashion. And then I had the thrill of introducing the man who won the first ball game ever played in Yankee Stadium from an offensive standpoint, George Herman Babe Ruth, and he stood up in the stands because he hit a home run, you see, with two men on base, Whitey Witt and Jumpin' Joe Dugan. And that enabled them to beat the Red Sox opening day at Yankee Stadium, the first game ever played at Yankee Stadium, by a score of 4-1. He drove in three runs with that homer. So then, anyway, I go on and say, and the season wore on, and it's a triple battle for first place. The Red Sox knocked the Yankees out of the pennant on a Saturday, and they had a chance to tie the Indians for the pennant on a Sunday, which they did. Cleveland lost and Boston won. And then the only playoff game in the history of the American League, Cleveland won it in a one-game playoff, and then beat the Braves, who then were in Boston, in the World Series. But I said the topper to me came several weeks later when, strangely, the two dignitaries who threw out the two first balls on the two opening day games of the Yankees, the one road game, the one at home, ran against each other for the presidency of the United States. Mr. Truman went to bed early election night, dash, going, going, gone, dash, but awoke early the next morning still in first place.
Good point. Mel Allen, thank you very much for being our guest tonight on the Golden Age of Radio.
Thank you. I certainly appreciate it, and I hope when I do get to the Golden Age, I'm still around, and you too, and maybe we'll do one, and get some added information in here.
And until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs.
Tonight's excerpts were provided through the courtesy of Jack Miller of Hamden, Connecticut. Re-recording was by Sam Balnius. The editor was Bob Sherago. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bill Grasty and Dick Bertel. The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Cromwell Savings Bank, located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell, and near Kmart at the new Plaza office, a friendly bank in a friendly town.
Pepper Young's Family. The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Camay, the mild beauty soap for a smoother, softer complexion.